Yes, thank you very much, dear Thomas, for this kind introduction. It will be the first time I try to express some of my thoughts on C.S. Lewis in English. I'm writing in English, that's quite usual for me, but I haven't tried to express it in live language. So I hope everything goes well and you will understand what I try to say. So, thank you very much for that you have come, so many fold here. I understand it is part of your program of studies. You are not completely on your own here, but I hope that you are also curious to hear something about C.S. Lewis, and I hope you will see that he has something to offer to us even more than 50 years after his death. I don't know how much C.S. Lewis is known to you. I guess some of you have read the Chronicles of Narnia, or seen one or more of these films, his fantasy stories for children, or the radio talks that Lewis gave in the 1940s, later published as Mere Christianity. Or you may know his famous Screwtape letters, which have also been published as a kind of cartoon. A book that discusses in satirical form questions of Christian faith and life. This young gentleman from hell here tries to prevent a human scholar from learning anything from the past. Or you may have read some of Lewis's many essays about matters of philosophy and theology, the problem of pain or miracles, or there are many more. So I hope C.S. Lewis is not a perfect stranger to you. And I've been at the library and seen there are many, many books of Lewis here in the library. It's of course impossible to present the whole C.S. Lewis, his life and thinking, in one short lecture. My aim is to give you in the next 60 minutes a sketch of Lewis as a defender of the Christian faith, or as an apostle to the skeptics, as Chet Walsh has titled the first full book about Lewis in 1949. Lewis's aim was to show his skeptical fellow countrymen in the 1930s till the 1960s that it is possible to be a modern, rational, educated person and yet to remain a Christian. But in which sense was Lewis's audience already an audience of skeptics? Many of his listeners and readers had been raised in the faith, but they had ceased to believe in Christ because this seemed to be incompatible with the insights of Enlightenment and modern science. We may call them skeptics because they wanted to know the truth, but they were not satisfied with the things they heard in church and contemporary theology. They wanted to know the answers to their questions, but they were no longer content to hear mere assertions. They allowed themselves to be convinced by argument. Now, in my experience, such a skeptical attitude towards religion is much harder to find today than Lewis's own time, or even 20 or 30 years ago. In the 1990s, I gave many courses in religious education for pupils of the senior classes of German schools. And the young boys and girls came and had questions, many questions. And they wanted to get their questions answered by us, their attendants. What is the meaning of life? Is there any such meaning? Does God really exist? And if he does, what is he like? Surely not as in those primitive stories that we heard in Sunday school. If the Christian view of God is true, are all the other religions wrong? And what about the problem of evil? If God is good and almighty, why is there still so much pain and suffering in the world? In my own experience, less and less people ask such questions today, even among the students of theology that I came across during the past years. I was surprised to see how quickly some of them presented in their discussions, their ready-made answers. And these were usually the answers of Catechism and Roman Magisterium. There's nothing wrong with these two. I have no doubts about the truth of the Roman Jew. That's not the point. My point is that these students gave their answers but did not show the slightest sign of awareness for the seriousness of the questions involved. The attitude was rather, why should I ask such difficult questions? It's enough for me if the church tells me what a thing is or what it ought to be. We can find a similar attitude, of course, also among non-believers, then, of course, with recourse to other authorities. Is there any reason, any deeper reason for this widespread attitude? I suspect yes. It seems to me that less and less people dare to ask these questions because the world has become so complex, so short-lived, and so uncertain. Many, especially young people, have ceased to believe that there could be an answer to their questions, an answer that might be found by reading books and discussing arguments. For if there is no hope to find such an answer, and preferably the right one, that is the one we were hoping for, it would be safer to abstain from asking these questions. Or else, if it's impossible, then we are tempted to adopt not only a question, but at the same time also its ready-made answer, whoever may provide it. For example, Richard Dawkins with his bus campaign, "There is probably no God," for atheists, or some other people with Pope and Magisterium. At least some of my students did this. As a result, we still hear many answers, atheistic, agnostic, or Christian. But it seems that there are less and less people who have found the answers by working themselves through to them from the initial questions. That is, by the way, in my opinion, one of the main reasons for the fundamentalism of our time. But what have these deliberations to do with C.S. Lewis? Here's another picture. Very much, I'd say. For the young Jack Lewis, as he called himself, had been a skeptic who refused to accept simple, ready-made answers. He kept on asking until he found an answer that satisfied him also intellectually. And the answer he finally found was, very much to his own surprise, the Christian one. The first thing that Lewis would say to us is thus, ask your own questions. I also did this. And do not be content with mere assertions. May they come from philosophers, theologians, or scientists. Try to get for yourself to the bottom and the heart of everything. But in order to do this, and this is the next thing he would say to us, you must be ready to put yourself into question. And then it may happen that you get a result that you did not expect, and which is not welcome to you because it upsets your own dearest convictions. According to Owen Barfield, who was a lifetime friend, but also an intellectual opponent of C.S. Lewis, this was characteristic for him. He was always ready to follow a line of thought to its logical conclusion, irrespective of how pleasant or welcome the result was for him. And because of this, Lewis's quest for the truth finally brought him back to Christ. A few years ago, Thomas has said something about that. I had the privilege to co-publish some texts with which Lewis wrote when he was not yet a Christian, but a philosophical pantheist of a sort. We see in these documents some of the changes that finally brought him back to Christ. This is exciting because it reveals how many of Lewis's arguments for the Christian faith are actually arguments which had convinced him before that his own previous beliefs were false. And Lewis kept this open mind, this readiness to question, if necessary, himself and his own convictions for his entire life. In 1961, some months after the painful death of his wife, he published a book in which he drew into question everything he had believed until then, including God's goodness, which is of course central for the Christian view of God. At the end of the book, Lewis reaffirms his own previous beliefs, but only after having raised the blackest doubts in between. And he confesses that this time of contestation was necessary for the sake and the honesty of his own beliefs. I have started with these preliminary remarks in order to explain why I think that C.S. Lewis has still something to offer to us. As I said, I will not present the whole Lewis, but only that part of his work that is concerned with apologetics. And I will proceed now in three main steps. In the first step, I'd like to say a bit more about Lewis's biography, because his journey to the faith left its traces in his philosophy and theology, as well as in his apologetic method. In my second step, I will deal with Lewis's critical examination of some typically modern assumptions, especially with our modern devotion to the methods of scientific research. In my last step, I will follow the question of the faith's reasonableness right into the heart of Lewis's theology. Okay, first point, some remarks about the person and biography of C.S. Lewis. Lewis was born in 1898 in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and died 1963 in Oxford. He was educated at two English schools and by a private tutor before he went to Oxford in 1917 in order to study philosophy and literature. Before he could take up his studies, he was called to active service in the First World War. He was sent to France and reached the frontier on his 19th birthday. In April 1918, he was wounded by an English shell, so their own people, by accident, and was sent home to England. A year later, he started in Oxford with his studies, and after he finished his studies, he tried at first to find a job as a philosopher. But then, in 1925, he switched to English literature due to the lack of jobs in the field of philosophy. He worked then for almost 30 years at Oxford's Magdalen College as a tutor for medieval and Renaissance literature. In the 1930s, a circle of friends emerged around J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, the so-called Inklings group. These friends met on a regular basis in order to talk about philosophy, theology, and literature. And they read to each other parts of their own nascent works. Tolkien, for example, read as these meetings excerpts from the Lord of the Rings for the first time. The Inklings usually met two times a week, one time in the morning in the pub Eagle Eye Child. We can still visit it. And the other time in the afternoon in Lewis's college rooms. There are, of course, no audio recordings of these meetings, but there are letters which might give us an idea of them. I give you an example. In his novel Perelandra, Lewis describes how his hero Ransom travels to the planet Venus, and here he meets a lady with green skin. Can see this lady. Dorothy Sayers, another member of the Inklings and author of the Lord Peter Wimsey detective novels, is not content with Lewis's description. She wants to know the color of the lady's hair. Lewis writes in a letter, "I asked Ransom about the lady's hair." He said,
"Oh, it was lovely."
"Yes, but what color?" "Not on top of the green, surely."
"I see. How the hell should one remember? I never remember the color of the girl's hair. I really want to know."
"Someone asked me."
"Oh, a woman, I think."
"Well, as a matter of fact, it was." There the matter ended. But he could remember the eyes. They were violet. Okay. After having worked as a tutor for almost 30 years, the University of Cambridge offered Lewis in 1954 a chair in his particular field of scholarship, which he held until his death in 1963. In 1957, he married Joy Davidman. Oh. Okay, we'll see the picture later. He married Joy Davidman, an American Jew and former Marxist who had found a way to the Christian faith in part with the aid of Lewis's books. At the time of marriage, Joy, who had two young sons, was ill with bone cancer in the final stage. As if by a miracle, or maybe due to a miracle, Lewis himself thought this possible, her condition suddenly improved, and the couple was able to spend 3 more years together. Then the cancer returned and Joy died. There are 2 movies which tell the story of Jack and Joy, a British TV film and a Hollywood production from 1994 with Anthony Hopkins in the role of C.S. Lewis, directed by Richard Attenborough. Very good film. You should try to see him. Okay. I had a picture of the film cover. Ah, that's Jack and Joy. And here, this is the German version. Okay, I said that Lewis was a tutor for English literature by profession. He supervised students and conducted seminaries for them. He wrote several books of literary scholarship and gave very popular lectures. As a Christian layman, he tried to give other people, often not academically trained, a contemporary understanding of the Christian faith. That is to say, he worked as a translator of Christian doctrine into the language and thought of his own time. Lewis refrained in his public statements from discussing questions that were controversial between the different denominations. Not because he thought these questions irrelevant, but because he was sure that they come only second for someone who wonders whether Christianity is true at all. And he answered thousands of letters in which readers and listeners asked for his advice in matters of faith. In later years, he took each day an hour in order to respond to all these letters. The society that Lewis spoke to had become quite secular in the first half of the 20th century. The religious knowledge of many Englishmen had become so sparse that they didn't know even the most basic things. Lewis gives an amusing example for such a lack of knowledge. One day in December, his brother Warren passed in a bus a church that had a manger in front of it, something like that. And then his brother heard a woman say to her companion, "Oh Lord, they bring religion into everything. Look, they are dragging it even into Christmas now." But he also recognized that the main reason for the turning away from the faith were problems to understand the language of theology and church. In his opinion, any person who wants to work in the field of evangelization must learn the language of his or her audience first. Here's another picture. Lewis even gave prospective young theologians vocabulary lists with religious terms and a second column in which he noted the meaning these terms had for their audience. The Immaculate Conception, for example, means in the mouth of an uneducated speaker always the virgin birth. Morality means chastity, never anything else. And dogma means, for most people, an unproved assertion delivered in an arrogant manner. But there were also deeper misunderstandings, which were not only questions of definition. Many people, for example, had come to disbelieve in Christianity because the doctrine of hell seemed to them immoral. Can we really believe that there is a God who loves his people, but who keeps minutely record of even our smallest sins, and who finally decides who of us shall be saved and who not, who goes up and who goes down? And is it really fair to be punished for our transitory sins with everlasting hell? Lewis's answer to these questions is simple but illuminating. It is not God who sends some of us into hell and others not. The doors of hell are locked on the inside. It is we, ourselves, who decide to stay in hell by shutting us up against God, and by doing so cut us off from communion with him, which is heaven. Lewis thus claimed that every exam in theology should include a translation exercise, the translation of a theological text into ordinary language. And in his opinion, to pass this test should be compulsory for any prospective priest or youth leader. For if we are not able to express our own beliefs in ordinary language, there are only two possibilities, according to Lewis. Either we do not understand our own beliefs, or else we do not really believe in what we are saying. I already mentioned another aspect of Lewis's biography, which is, to my opinion, still relevant today. It had taken him years to recognize the truth of those beliefs that he later tried to pass on to others. Lewis had been baptized into the Anglican Church as a child, but he had abandoned his childhood beliefs when he was about 14. His study of philosophy had made him realize the inconsistency of his materialistic atheism. I'll say a bit more about that later on. Lewis turned to idealism, which was an influential philosophy in Oxford back then. This idealism was essentially a pantheistic interpretation of the philosophy of Hegel. But although this idealism seemed to be intellectually satisfactory, it became more and more difficult for Lewis to keep it up, because he could not live by it. He realized that every attempt to live according to this philosophy ended in the same desperate wish to ask God for his help. His philosophy declared that this was absurd, but he felt the need to pray to God. In July 1930, he gave in and acknowledged that God is God, and he fell on his knees and prayed. And he recognized that the world is not simply identical with God. God created something that is not himself in order that this creation may enter into a relation with him. But this was still not the last stage of his religious journey. 1.5 years later, he finally came to believe in Jesus Christ. And this was the reason Lewis, being a literary historian, couldn't help seeing that the Gospels are no mere myths or legends. They claim to record events that have historically happened, at least in their main aspects. There was no doubt for him the prosaic way in which the Gospels write about Jesus' life has no parallel in the myths of religious history. But he saw, nevertheless, one striking parallel between the Gospels and many pagan myths. The main theme of the Gospels is precisely one of the main themes of the great myths. For in pagan mythology, there are also gods who die and rise again to new life: Adonis, Osiris, Baldur, and many more. The idea that the divine sacrifices itself in order to bring new life to the world is precisely the same in the myths and in the Gospels. And it is an incredible idea, which should make us tremble and react with awe if we are only willing to get ourselves into it. The ability to move us deeply, although we cannot exactly say why, is, in Lewis's opinion, a feature of all great myths. They can give us experiences of such a deep meaning that they make us see the whole world in a new light. Experiences of deep meaning, yes, but are they true? Is this felt meaning more than a mere fancy? Lewis admitted that in the case of pagan myths, this question must remain open. But in the case of the Gospels, the answer is yes. This story is true, although it's still a myth. A long nightly talk with two friends, one of them was this gentleman, J.R.R. Tolkien, convinced Lewis in September 1931 that the Gospels tell not merely a story invented by men. They record something that actually happened on the level of history. The old myth of the dying god came down from the heaven of myth to the earth of history. It happened in first century Palestine, when Pontius Pilate was prefect of Judea. But although it is history, the story of Christ does not lose its deep meaning for all men at all times. To the contrary, it shows us what the history of the world is really about. In Christ, God himself became man, suffered and died for us, and brought us new life. This insight enabled Lewis to become a Christian, and there are other people who were also impressed by it. It is, for example, quoted in a book by this renowned man, in the first of the book of the Jesus trilogy. But Lewis did not join the Roman Church. He returned to the Anglican Church, in which he had been baptized. Tolkien, who was a Roman Catholic, always regretted this. What's the point of all this? In my opinion, the important point is that Lewis came to believe in Christ only at the end of a long intellectual journey. He passed the steps of this journey not on the supposition that the Christian faith is true, but on the supposition that it's false. It was thus evident for him as a converted skeptic that it must be possible to show non-believers on their own premises that Christ is the answer to their search for truth and meaning. In his own case, Christ had been the answer, and it was this experience which he tried to convey to his skeptical fellow men. One last biographical hint. The process which finally brought him to Christ was also important for his view of the relation between Christianity and the other religions. For him, who had only gradually approached the faith from the outside, who had loved Balder before Christ and Plato before St. Augustine, it was impossible that Christianity should be the only true religion and all the other religions and philosophies simply false. It would have been a serious argument against Christianity if there had been no parallels in other religions. No, Christianity was by no means wholly different from what philosophy and the heathen myths had told him before. Lewis writes, quote, "I could not believe Christianity if I were forced to say that there were 1,000 religions in the world, of which 999 were pure nonsense and the thousands fortunately true. My conversion very largely depended on recognizing Christianity as the completion, the actualization and telechy of something that had never been wholly absent from the mind of man." And Lewis was not only willing to acknowledge important elements of truth in other religions, he even claims that what is common to the serious believers of all denominations and even religions is much more fundamental than the things that separate them. In other words, Lewis believes that in a world of the spirit, the countries meet not at their borders, but in their center. The closer you get to the heart of your own community, the closer you get also to the heart of the other communities. The true believers of each religion are thus closer to each other than either of them is to a half-hearted or a fanatical member of his own denomination. I think this is an idea we could think about, especially in our time, where the ugly, fanatical, violent face of misused religion seems to me almost omnipresent. But according to Lewis, this does not amount to a dispensation of the question of truth. It does matter what you believe, for the center of the spiritual world is not nowhere and everywhere. It is a concrete place. It has even a name, Jesus Christ, who is the Word of God. Those who sincerely follow their own religion are thus also close to Christ, may they know this or not. In the Narnia story, The Last Battle, Lewis uses the figure of Emmet, Hebraic for truth, in order to illustrate this conviction. Emmet believes in Tush, the heathen god of his people, and he tries to live with his heart and soul what he believes to be true and good, even if it is difficult or may bring him into trouble. Aslan, the Christ figure of Narnia, he rejects, because he has heard only bad and cruel things about him. But when he dies, Emmet finds himself face to face with Aslan, and one single look at him is enough to show him that he has been wrong about him for all his life. Emmet falls on his knees, acknowledges Aslan as his Lord and God, and awaits his judgment. Because he has served the wrong God, he expects to be rejected and punished. But Aslan appreciates everything that was good and true in his service to Tash. He values it as a service to himself and admits Emmet into his kingdom. It seems to me that Lewis is saying here almost exactly the same as Karl Rahner in his theory of the anonymous Christian. Okay, this was my first part. Now, some more remarks about Lewis's critical view of modern philosophy and science. I have no really idea what the time says. The modern age seems to have come to an end by now. We already live in the postmodern age, but the prejudices against modernity, against the Christian faith, nevertheless still prevent many people from believing in God. It is here that C.S. Lewis may still be useful, because he had to overcome these prejudices for himself before he returned to Christ. A skeptical mind was thus for him not a hindrance, but a help on his journey back to the Christian faith. Lewis even writes that, quote, agnosticism is, in a sense, what I'm preaching. I do not wish to reduce the skeptical element in your minds. I'm only suggesting that it need not be reserved exclusively for the New Testament and the creeds. Try doubting something else. And we must start doubting something else, at least those modern assumptions which stand in direct opposition to the faith. We must try to show that they are neither scientific facts nor philosophical truths. In 1947, it seems, there were only few people who still held this to be possible. This shows a title story in the renowned Time magazine about C.S. Lewis. For this story presents him as a heretic among the intellectuals. That is, an intellectual who believes in Christ. We read under the image his heresy, Christianity. And this he was, a heretic even among the intellectuals of his own academic home, Oxford. His own Magdalen College was a stronghold of neo-positivism. One of his colleagues was Gilbert Ryle, one of the most influential analytical philosophers of his time. Most colleagues of Lewis found his popular books about religious themes simply embarrassing, and they shook their heads all the more when he started to write religious fantasy for children. Lewis himself reacted to this repudiation with humor and a grain of self-irony. We can see this in his answer to a letter which he received in 1944 from the U.S. American Society for the Prevention of Progress. This society was obviously very anti-modern. And it offered Lewis a lifetime membership and summoned him to put forward his credentials. He answered, "Dear sir, while feeling that I was born a member of your society, I am nevertheless honored to receive the outward seal of membership. I shall hope by continued orthodoxy and the unremitting practice of reaction, obstruction, and stagnation to give you no reason for repenting your favor. Yours regressively, C.S. Lewis." As a testimonial, he included his book, The Abolition of Man, a book which contains almost everything that the dialectics of enlightenment also tried to say, and which is quoted with approval in the works of Hans Jonas, Jürgen Habermas, and Josef Ratzinger. But although he knew that he was an outsider in the academic world of Oxford, Lewis was nevertheless willing to advocate his position in public. This we can see from his involvement with the Oxford University Socratic Club. The Socratic Club had been founded in 1941 in order to provide a discussion forum between Christians and non-Christians. Advocates and critics of Christianity were invited to give a talk in order to present their position. The speakers should preferably be experts in their own field. A representative of the opposing side responded to the speaker, and an open discussion followed, which stood under the Platonic maxim, follow the argument wherever it leads. Here only reasons and arguments should matter, irrespective of how old they were or who uttered them. Lewis was president of the Socratic Club from 1941 until 1954, and he was the main figure in the discussion. He often stepped in when a speaker ran out of arguments, and he read quite a few papers to the club. This club was a kind of cell of resistance against the philosophy of neo-positivism in England. Towards the middle of the 20th century, neo-positivism seemed to have won the war against religion. The positivists used the so-called verification principle. They claimed that statements about things that cannot be scientifically observed are meaningless. And this was, in their opinion, true for metaphysics and theology as a whole. To them, traditional metaphysics was merely a confused form of speaking about purely natural events, and it seemed that the human soul would soon also be abolished. In the wake of Ryle's book, The Concept of Mind, published in 1950, all theories about the human spirit vanished for about 10 years from analytical philosophy. But the positivists had not won all the way through. Even A.J. Ayer, an influential pupil of Ryle, admitted this in his memoirs. Not the whole British Empire was occupied by the positivists. A small debating society in Oxford made still a stand against them. The Socratic Club with C.S. Lewis as president. Lewis himself points here to David Hume, the father of the British empiricism. For Hume already admitted that the meaningless world he described could only be born by playing backgammon. Lewis thus encourages us to search for an alternative to it. Quote, if there should, after all, turn out to be any alternative to a philosophy that can be supported only by repeated and presumably increasing doses of backgammon, I suppose that many people would be glad to hear of it. Out of Lewis's many arguments in support of such an alternative worldview, I can present now only one. It takes our present scientific way of looking at the world as its starting point and runs like this. If we put our focus on those aspects of our experiences that can be scientifically observed and put into mathematical formula, everything that happens in the world will be reduced to material causes and their effects that follow from them according to the laws of nature. Other aspects of the experience, like the subjective smell or the color of a flower or whatever, or the sound of a voice, they simply don't matter. And this is even more the case if we put our focus on purely technical aspects. Thomas Hobbes already wrote in 1651 that to know a thing means to know what we can do with it when we have it. A person who adopts this attitude will have made himself blind for any other aspect of the observed object, blind for questions of freedom and personality, meaning, value, and truth. It is, of course, possible to say, so what? These questions of meaning, value, and truth are no scientific questions. Why should I be bothered about that? Well, we should be bothered precisely in that moment in which a person proposes to explain everything in terms of mere causes and effects, also the truth claim of our human judgments. For I, as a thinking person, am convinced that a certain statement is true or a certain action is morally right because I have seen it to be thus, because I have reasons to do so, and not merely because physical processes in my brain force me to believe this. But these reasons, like the laws of formal logic, never even appear in the scientific description of my acts of thinking. I could, for example, ask a professor of theology like this one if he is willing to be hooked up and shoved into a modern CT scanner while he is thinking about the philosophy of Immanuel Kant. And then the brain specialist would very probably find some neural activity in his brain. He would observe patterns of neural excitation, the rising of new connections between different brain areas or more. But he wouldn't find anything that even remotely resembles a categorical imperative or the law of non-contradiction. Shall we conclude that these concepts have no influence whatever on his actual thinking? There can be no doubt the results of such experiments are in fact quite often claimed to reveal the illusory character of our beliefs about God and ourselves. This was the case in Lewis's time when neo-positivism had become the prevalent philosophy. And this is a case today when neuroscientists like Wolf Singer in Germany claim that the idea of human freedom is a mere illusion, because science has proven that our brain processes determine our whole behavior as human beings. And other scientists like Richard Dawkins put forward quite similar theories with regard to man's evolutionary development. And this is no marginal phenomenon. The God delusion, Dawkins' famous attack on religion, was not only on the bestseller lists of the booksellers. In Germany, it also received an award as the science book of the year 2008. Lewis claimed as early as 1943 that such a naturalistic attitude abolishes everything that is essentially human. I already mentioned the book, The Abolition of Man, and it might be possible that you have heard its title also from the lips of another famous critic of scientism. Our Pope Emeritus Benedict did not only borrow this formula from Lewis, he even dedicated a whole essay to this book. And there are also people like the British, philosopher Peter Williams, who maintain that it's still possible to refute the theories of today's new atheists by using arguments that were developed by C.S. Lewis more than 50 years ago. Now, what does Lewis reply to such theories? He begins his reply with the observation that there are two possible approaches to man, and not only one. On the one side, there is a scientific look at a human being from the outside. But on the other side, there is our subjective way of experiencing things from the inside. And this is highly important. For on the one hand, natural events stand in the relation of causes and effects to each other, and they follow each other according to the laws of nature. And this is, of course, also what happens in the brain of our theologian if he is in the brain scanner. This is a view from the outside, the scientific look at man. But our acts of thinking are only valid in the sense of being true insights into the nature of reality if each step of our argument is connected with the previous one on the level of grounds and consequence. Only if we see why a certain hypothesis must be true, we are justified to call it true. This is something that happens inside our minds. It cannot be scientifically observed from the outside. But most naturalists accept the level of cause and effect as the only form of causation. They claim that the mental events in our heads are wholly irrelevant for the occurrence of our actual beliefs. The brain specialist Wolf Singer, for example, who I mentioned a moment ago, claims that we never think or do anything but what our brains force us to think or do. He believes that we only fancy being rational persons that are capable of genuine insights. Our brains mislead us to believe that we are the origin of our own deeds and insights. In reality, the material processes in our brain produce our behavior. Well, everything else is sheer illusion. Lewis would retort to Singer that he commits here the same self-contradiction that he, Lewis, had committed while he was an atheist. For if our brains only produce the illusion of having rational grounds for our beliefs, not a single thought in the world would ever be thought because it's true. And what then about Professor Singer's own beliefs? He claims that they have been proven by contemporary neuroscience. But neuroscience itself is not a material thing. It is a mental conception that is something inside of Professor Singer's head. It would thus also be a mere product of blind and mindless natural processes on the level of cause and effect. Imagine our theologian Thomas, thank you very much, would change his place in the computer tomographer with Professor Singer, who is now in turn examined by another neuroscientist. What would this neuroscientist say about the origin and the truth claims of Professor Singer's own philosophy and science? He would very probably say that Singer did not adopt them because he has seen them to be true, but because the material processes in his head determined it to believe them. Lewis thus concludes that such theories cut off the ground from under their own feet. They claim, in effect, to have proven that all proofs are invalid. There is no truth. How shall this claim be true? Lewis does not claim that all forms of naturalism can be refuted by means of such a reductio ad absurdum. Elizabeth Anscombe, a pupil of the famous Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, convinced him in a debate in the Socratic Club that there are forms of naturalism that remain untouched by this charge of self-refutation. Lewis thus reformulated his argument and added a new paragraph that is directed towards non-reductionist forms of naturalism. This argument is so complex that I cannot present it here, but just one short comment about it. Lewis fully acknowledged Anscombe's critic, and he even followed her objections up to their logical conclusion. And then he realized that the epistemic problem of naturalism is not solved, it has only been moved to another place. If our argument has been sound, what would the benefit be? Well, then we would at least know that it never suffices to look at a human being only from the outside, as it is done in the sciences. It is impossible in principle to dispense with the inside view, which we adopt while we are in an experience. In other words, the inside experience of rational thinking is the starting point of every explanation of the world, also of the explanations of the scientist. And no philosophical or scientific theory can be true that is unable to account for this simple fact. We are therefore justified in rejecting a certain popular idea of scientific rationality, which of course not yet proves that Christianity must be true. But there's at least room enough for a dialogue between science, philosophy, and religion in which Christianity has a chance to get a fair hearing. The philosopher Helmut Kuhn sums up this part of Lewis's apologetics in the following words, quote, "It is rational to believe this is the message, and we must clear away an irrational conception of reason in order to do this." Quote end. In my opinion, this is a pretty good description of what Lewis tried to achieve in the Socratic Club. And I'm sure that a forum like the Socratic Club would still be a gain for every theological faculty. It would show that contemporary theology is willing to enter into dialogue with the other sciences. And it would also be a gain for every university, for it would show that it is really the quest for truth that they promote and not merely certain modern ideologies. That it is really reasons and arguments that count, irrespective of who may put them forward. Okay, and now to my last shorter point, the role of reason in the theology of C.S. Lewis. I think I have another picture, yes. I said that Lewis had found in Christianity the completion of his philosophical quest for truth. But when he came to believe in Christ, he recognized that his previous conception of God had not simply been wrong. The Christian revelation was able to add to his idea of God, just as his experience of a personal God had added to his purely philosophical idea of an absolute spirit. The God of Christianity was thus for Lewis more than the God of the philosophers, not less, nor a wholly different kind of being. This view of the relation between the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the God of the philosophers is also the basis for Lewis's view of the incarnation. I close my lecture with some remarks about this theme. Lewis's starting point is here not the faculty of reason in general, but practical reason at man's faculty to judge between good and evil. Now, in order to act according to our own insights, we must, of course, be free. Freedom, autonomy, self-determination, these are basic concepts of our whole modern way of seeing the world. And Lewis does not simply reject these concepts. He relates to them in a positive way. That is to say, he is not merely critical about modern philosophy, he is also willing to use their insights when he takes them to be valid. But what is freedom, we might ask? Does freedom simply mean that I can do whatever I happen to like? Does freedom mean that nobody and nothing gets in my way, even if I should choose to do one thing today and tomorrow quite the reverse? Is that the whole idea of freedom? Lewis says no. In the Pilgrim's Regress, his allegorical presentation of his own conversion story, there's a figure called Virtue, which represents the moral person. And Virtue almost falls into despair because he initially understands freedom only in such a negative way, that is, as the absence of alien forces. For Virtue recognizes that this is not enough. If he is free to do anything he likes, how can he know what he should do? Wouldn't this mean that his actual deeds are wholly irrelevant? If everything is allowed and there's no reason for to do a particular thing or its opposite, then all our acts are without any sense or meaning. But then Virtue meets Mr. Wisdom, who represents the philosophy of enlightenment, of Kant, Fichte, and Hegel. And he shows Virtue that there is a standard for his actions as a free man, which is not imposed on him from the outside, and thus does not lead him into heteronomy. This is a standard of goodness which he finds inside himself as a rational being. It is the voice of practical reason, which can guide us in our actions and which we hear in our own conscience. In other words, because we are rational beings, we can give the moral law to ourselves. And if we obey this self-given law, we are not determined by alien forces, we are autonomous. This is, by the way, also the basic idea behind Kant's categorical imperative. According to Lewis, this idea of man's autonomy is essential for any sound theory of ethics. But how, we may ask, can this idea of man's freedom be reconciled with the Christian claim that we act rightly only if we are doing God's will? Lewis sees no real conflict between God's will and man's practical reason. For God's commands are never purely arbitrary. God could never bid us to hate one another or lie as often as possible. He is himself reason, and his commands are always perfectly reasonable. It is thus true to say that it is God who speaks in our conscience, but it is also the voice of reason, for these are actually the same. Lewis concludes that if God had never spoken to us other than with the voice of practical reason, we would be justified in using its judgments as the sole guidance for our actions. But God has spoken to us also in other ways. This is what we believe. For Lewis, it is thus reasonable to listen to these utterances as well. In other words, God can tell us more about his own will than by speaking in our conscience alone. And he can reveal to us the deeper meaning of the laws of practical reason. According to Christianity, this is precisely what has happened in the Incarnation. God has told us in Jesus Christ who is and how we should live and act. Jesus' words and deeds are thus for Lewis also the final standard for our human behavior. It is thus impossible for Lewis that there should be any contradiction between Jesus' sayings and the laws of practical reason. To the contrary, every experience of an ethical ought, as well as every saying of one of the great human moral teachers, is a reflection of that deeper reality that was fully revealed to us only in Christ. According to Lewis, the same is also true for the relation between Jesus and the Jewish law. Jesus did not come to abolish the Torah, he came to fulfill it through his life and death. But he did not simply repeat the twofold law of loving God and our neighbor. He showed us the true meaning of this law. In his life and death, we see what happens when God's own love acts under human conditions. But Jesus was not only true God, he was also true man. In his life, we thus see also what it means to live a truly human life. For Lewis, the modern idea of man's freedom has yet another important implication for theology. This is my last point. We may infer from the modern idea of freedom that human history is not merely an evolutionary process and it follows not a simple predetermined pattern. The human actors are free in their acting, so that history is a series of unpredictable, dramatic events. But in a dramatic story, no event can be isolated from the rest of the story. Every person contributes with his or her own acts to the shape of the whole story. It is therefore possible that the deeds of a single person seal the fate, victory or defeat, happiness or misery of all the people involved. We see this, for example, in historical events like Graf Stauffenberg's assault on Hitler, which failed, or in stories like Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. The fate of whole Middle-earth depends on Frodo and Sam alone, two little hobbits from the Shire. Their successful attempt to destroy the one great ring matters more than the whole ring war with thousands of participants. According to Christianity, the central crucial event of the world's history is the incarnation, the story of God becoming man in Jesus of Nazareth, his life in first century Palestine, his death and resurrection. Seen from this perspective, the incarnation is also the greatest drama that has ever taken place in the history of the world. And we will see this history only aright, as the great Swiss theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar would say, if we recognize that it is such a dramatic story. In Lewis's opinion, it is thus not contrary to reason to believe that God has revealed to us the deepest meaning of our human lives in a series of concrete historical events. To the contrary, it is also open to philosophical scrutiny that God has spoken to us in the form of such a dramatic story. Lewis sums up his belief in the form of a personal confession. Quote, "Christian theology can fit in science, art, morality, and the sub-Christian religions. The scientific point of view cannot fit in any of these things, not even science itself. I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." You can read this last sentence now also in the Poets' Corner of London's Westminster Abbey, which commemorates the great British authors. Lewis was admitted here in the 50th year of his death in 2013. This is the memorial plaque, and we can see the sentence there. My sketch of C.S. Lewis as a defender of the Christian faith ends here. There is no need to agree with everything that I said in the last 60 minutes, neither with my presentation of Lewis nor with his own position. A further discussion about him is not only justified but also welcome, and I would guess that it's also to Lewis's own liking, as long as it keeps true to the Socratic maxim which I quoted before, follow the argument wherever it leads. Thank you very much.